The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Good evening, everyone, and thanks so much for joining us at the Free Library of Philadelphia at home. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. Just a few housekeeping notes before we begin. I want to point your attention to the green buttons below, which you can click to purchase our guest book, Heavy and Breathe, or you can order them from your local bookshop. On screen, you'll also see the Ask a Question link, which you can use to ask a question, suggest a topic, or upvote a question that you like. I'll ask as many of your questions as we can, but accept my apology in advance. I know we're not going to get to anywhere close to all of them. It's now my honor to welcome back our guests. Imani Perry is the Hughes Rogers Professor of African American Studies and Faculty Associate in the Program in Law and Public Affairs and Gender and Sexuality Studies at Princeton University. She is the author of 6 books, most recently the award-winning titles Breathe, A Letter to My Sons, and Looking for Lorraine, The Radiant and Radical Life of Lorraine Hansberry. She was born in Birmingham, Alabama, and currently lives outside of Philly with her 2 sons. Kiese Lehman is the Hubert McAlexander Professor of English and Creative Writing at the University of Mississippi. He is the author of the novel Long Division, a collection of essays, How to Slowly Kill Yourself and Others in America, and the award winner, Heavy, an American Memoir. Lehman was born and raised in Jackson, Mississippi. Their topics this evening will be the uprising since George Floyd's murder and Black struggles for freedom in the United States. Imani and Kiese, the screen is yours.
Thank you.
Hey.
Hey, how you doing?
I don't know why, I'm just geeked. I'm so happy to be here with you. How you doing?
Me too. I'm holding on.
Your baby boy graduated today?
He graduated from the 8th grade, which is hard to believe.
How did it feel?
Like yesterday he was in our baby. It felt great, you know. I mean, it's hard, right? They've been in the house for 3 months, but you know, I'm grateful.
So you know how much I love you and how indebted I am to you for my professional life, my interior life. And I don't even know if you remember the first time we met. I had been teaching Prophets of the Hood. It came out 2004. I taught that book in every single class that I could teach it. And I was teaching a lot of writing classes. So I was teaching Prophets of the Hood and like composition courses and whatnot. And then you came to my classroom, and you probably don't remember this, but one of the things you said was like, you could tell you thought I was doing a decent job because the students seemed like they were cared for. And,
yes.
and for me, that was just the illest thing anybody could ever say to me. And Prophets of the Hood, I just want to say, like, at that point, it was Gorilla My Love and Fire Next Time. Like, those were the 3 books that just meant more than anything in the world. I mean, those were the 3 books that made me revisit them over and over and over and over and over again. So before we really start talking, though, I'm asking you to do a favor for me.
Okay.
And, I haven't heard you read Breathe like live before. And I just wonder if you could just read a piece of Breathe, because Breathe like broke me, opened me up as an artist, as a person. I just could not believe anybody could pull that shit off. And I just wanted to know if you could just start by reading something for us.
I will. And then I want to say something about that. That first meeting. Okay. This is from page 28. My children, you have seen us, the adults in your world, impotent to bring our lost ones back, to protect the children or the mothers or the fathers, or to even avenge their deaths, as useless as retribution would be when it comes to broken hearts. We've completely failed at making those who act with violent impunity stop what they're doing. In fact, a call to the police is an audaciously wielded weapon of white discontent these days. Andy Cooper. With each sin, the violent, hateful ones grow bolder. They know they can take our lives without consequence. And if not that, stage theaters of our humiliation. And yet, your power sustains. My father had the poem, Who Killed McDuffie, above his desk when I was growing up. It is a harrowing account of the unsolved murder of a black man in Miami in 1979. I'm sorry, there's some feedback, so it's hard to read it. I learned practically from birth that judicial procedure was a cruel choreography and not a fact-finding when it came to violence against black people. That is the terror that makes me want to say that could have been my child, and also that could have been me, even though thoughts of self cannot, should not take over our collective outrage and grief. And I know that despite my fear, I cannot clip your wings, as though cowering is a respectful tribute to the beauty we have lost. No, I want your wingspan wide to honor the departed, ancestral and immediate. B. Living defined by terror is itself destructive of the spirit, and it is submission. The truth is it that life is unsafe, and genius, more often than not, remains unvalidated, or even worse, dormant. But joy, even in slivers, shows up everywhere. Take it and keep taking it.
Thank you, fam.
Thank you.
Thank you. You still getting feedback?
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay.
I don't know why that is, but we can talk. It's all right. That first meeting we had at the hotel the night before I came to your class, I saw my friend ZZ Packer, who I think you had invited the day before. And she was another person with whom I had kismet. We went to college together, but then like halfway through, I realized she had been banned with my cousin in Louisville, Kentucky. And there are these moments, I think, particularly when those of us who, come from the dirty South and find our way in these rarefied spaces, how to recognize each other.
Yeah.
And I remember both reflecting on the care that you had for students, but also your commitment. And we talked about this to virtuosity.
And yo, you remember that shit? I was about to bring it up. Wow.
You know, just that the notion of excellence and integrity and beauty as a disposition that is in a kind of radical resistance to the ways in which we're both dehumanized and depicted. Right. And I was deeply moved by that and thrilled to meet you. And then I feel privileged because I knew what an extraordinary genius you are with the pen before the rest of the world did. And so I've also been really thrilled to see what you've opened up for people. I'm grateful for it. And Breathe is directly indebted to Heavy.
I just want to just jump right in because I'm not sure. Okay. I always think people are going to cut us off. That's that Southern thing.
Yes, right. Can't go on too much.
I'm interested in whether or not you want to talk about the distinction between being wildly courageous. Talking at the end of the book, when writing to your sons, you talk about being wildly courageous as opposed to being reckless.
Yeah.
And as a young person, I didn't understand the difference. And as an older person, I think I understand the difference. But I wonder if you could talk a bit more about for you, and if what you see right now in these communities, in these cities, in these streets is like wildly courageous and or recklessness, the distinction. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, I mean, it's there's so much going on. It's very difficult to assess it completely. I have been moved by the courage, though. You know, what it requires when you have seen day after day these people with the power of the state behind them have no compunction about being utterly violent.
Right.
And to still be able to say enough, mm-hmm. I'm going to face that. Mm-hmm. And every time all over the world that, you know, in, at least in places with violent police forces, that people stand before and say enough, they are making themselves vulnerable to death, literally.
Literally.
And I think I find myself incensed with some of the coverage because people act as though, oh, maybe the protesters are going too far. Mm-hmm. They want to talk about perhaps this will affect the election. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these things that, or they want to talk about broken windows, which strikes me as the most inhumane possible response. We are talking about people saying, you have to stop killing us.
Yeah.
And that potentially being the cause of their deaths. Right. So, I think there's a great deal of courage. I think there is, the force of what's right.
Right.
You know, there's a moral imperative behind, and to do it in a pandemic. So people are taking their lives at risk in more than one way.
Right.
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 Yeah. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just seeing, I'm seeing massive amounts of courage, and it's strange how courage, or maybe not strange, how courage is infectious.
Yeah.
And I'm interested in this because of Breathe, right? Like, I feel the courage, you know, I feel the courage to say to my job, which is the home of neo-Confederacy. Like, mm-hmm. I feel courage in this moment to say, like, if y'all don't rectify that and do right by the essential workers of the school, I'm out.
Yeah.
But I'm also rereading Breathe. It made me just wonder about, like, is that courage? And what does that courage have to do with not having children? Do you know what I mean? Not having sons that I could write heavy to. So I'm thinking a lot about how courage is sometimes is, you know, an inheritance that you talk so beautifully about, but also sometimes shaped by familiar forces. And I don't know if that's true, sure. but I'm wondering, do you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, we are all functioning with the structures of our individual lives, mm-hmm. right? And the ways in which we can exercise leverage that are not all the same, right? Right? I don't know if this is an exact answer, but one of the things that I thought about when I was after reading Heavy and then as I was writing Breathe was this question of what kind of person does one have to become in order and to live in the world that we imagine as the free, as free, right? Yeah. As the liberation that we're fighting for.
Right.
You know, you raise all these questions about becoming, and there's all these forces at play. There's, you know, there's patriarchy, there's the ideology of white supremacy, there's economic inequality, there's the wounds that we all live with, right? We have to swim through to get someplace. Mm-hmm. And it made me want to say as a mother that the thing that is most important to impart is not just, you know, excellence mm-hmm. and being well behaved. Mm-hmm. It's actually the kind of human relations you pursue, right? How right. can we be fit for the freedom right. that we want, right? Right? And I thought about this again when reading the story of Iyanna Dior, who's a trans yeah. woman who was beaten up right. by the Black folks at one of the protests. And I'm thinking, like, even, you know, that's a lesson. In the moment of resistance, we are right. called to be better than the kind of people who would pile on an injustice yes. as we're fighting against injustice, right? And so, you know, I do think that all those moments ask of different kinds of courage of us,
right?
Right. Right? Right. And they can feel reckless because we don't know what the consequence will be.
Right. And I think if you are blessed with the inheritances that we are coming from the Deep South, I think sometimes we do know what the consequences will be. And
Fine.
And you know, we got a message today from incredible poet L. Lamar Wilson, encouraging us to remind folks that, you know, 57 years ago today,
yes.
Fannie Lou Hamer was, people attempted to destroy Fannie Lou Hamer in a prison, in a jail about an hour from where I live in Winona, Mississippi.
Winona, yeah.
And part of the terror was that they made other Black men inmates beat her. Like
lost a vision in one eye, yes. destroyed her kidneys.
Yes. Right.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering, on one hand, what we do with that inheritance and what we do with your constant call to center, like, the joy that is us at the same time.
Yeah.
Like, how do we make, and I think Breathe is about making space for that. Like, that's one yeah. of Breathe is the most, one of the most magnificent books I've ever read. But can you just talk about how we hold both of those inheritances and move through the world, hopefully courageously, with that at our back and consequently at our front too?
I mean, I think that's the only way, you know, as Mahalia said, how we got over. I don't think that it is joy despite the terror, despite mm-hmm. the wounds. I think mm-hmm. it's actually a disposition mm-hmm. of constantly accessing the depth and breadth of our humanity as Black mm-hmm. folks. I mean, I think, you know, there's something radical about being fully.
Yeah.
While being debased at every single yeah. turn.
Yeah.
Right. And you know, there's a moment in Beloved, when one of the other women who is upset with Setha for having you know, killed her child, and but she takes up for her, and when the ghost comes back to overwhelm. And some of the things that have happened to her, she says she can't even articulate. She talks about the worst yet. That's the language mm. she uses, mm. right? And I think about the echo of that in the novel with the phrase, this is not a story to pass on, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, so when I'm talking about joy, it's never an evasion of the depth of the wounds. Mm-hmm. It is literally the sustaining life force. Right. Mm-hmm. And I also think there's a particular dimension, and I wanted to ask you about this, that comes from kind of being children of the movement
right.
and coming of age in a period where everybody, you feel like, okay, we lost.
Right.
Right. And right. in some ways being out of sync with where the world was and the late 70s, the 80s, mm-hmm. much of the 90s, mm-hmm. and living with the impact of all of that, with folks in prison, folks yeah. who had lost their minds, folks right. hungry. I mean, all of this as part of a day-to-day life that is talked about as having been in the past.
Yeah.
Right? And I don't know how much you think about that now. For me, it actually... it's the part that makes me afraid about this moment, because I yeah. know how much people are going to suffer,
mm-hmm.
Even if there are some victories. Mm-hmm. But maybe also as a form of preparation for it, too.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm there, and I mean, I'm holding two parts of myself at once. Like, I am completely there, but also as an artist, I find myself creating in this moment, that in this time and this movement. I want to talk about it as a movement, not a moment, whether it's right or not. I find myself like not knowing not just how to end pieces, but how to end sentences. Do you know? Because like, if I'm gonna be honest, like I have never felt like we were this collectively capable of. Now the "of" is the question,
right? But something can move dramatically now,
right? I, and you know, I know sometimes it's not cool to say that, and. But like literally, like in the way I carry my body and the way I'm doing my art, I'm just kind of torn now about like what kind of art do you create? When if you're gonna be honest with yourself, you see a possibility, you see possibilities here that I've never seen or imagined before. Conversely, because we are children of the movement, and I don't want to put this on you, but you know, I saw how shame manifested in a lot of our parents and our uncles and you know, the people who made us possible. And I have not done well with shame. Shame is something that I'm not, I don't do well with it. I don't do well with it. And so like, I'm wondering like what we do with this moment that is like just bubbling with possibility and with that inheritance of possibility being not broken but deterred and turned into some sort of shame from the generation that made us possible.
And then you ask the question of the art, and I want to talk about this moment also in terms of product, which is a different question than art.
Definitely. I would need to say that shit twice right there.
Yeah. Well, because there's suddenly this market, right? And outlets that we're not calling are calling, and there's lists and there's, you know, sales and all these things. And that's bumping up against this moment, which is both a moment of incredible grief and a moment of incredible possibility. And there is the imperative to create art that is meaningful, that is in service of our liberation. And then you wonder how much truth to tell.
Right. Do you?
Right?
Do you?
Absolutely. Uh-huh. Because I believe in telling the truth.
Because you know it's going to be made into a product?
Because I know it's going to be made into a product, but also because you never tell all the secrets when you're trying to get free. Right? I mean, you have to always hold some things back. And so the question of how much do you reveal about the whole matrix, right?
Right.
Right. And then on the other hand, you think we have to tell, because especially you've been thinking about, you know, what the beloved community would look like, what the free world, not just the free society, would look like. I'm rambling now, but I do feel like there's all of these pressures simultaneously, and I do. I think that the difficulty with the sentences, the difficulty with ending the pieces is okay, because we don't know where we're going. Mm-hmm. So it's enough to gesture towards ways of being with each other or possibilities that lead us towards something better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also hard for me because there's different hats, right? Like there's the part of me that has been working on law and policy issues. You could say we should do this, this, and this. And even that tends to be, those are interim steps, right? Another question would be is, well, what would it take to get completely free?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you talk and you write a lot about not just market and market-driven society, but like titillation as an idea.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you could say more about the importance and magnitude of titillation, like today, where we are. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I find myself, frankly, furious most days, at least part of the day, because I think the appetite for Black suffering is just vast right now. Right. And I don't like feeling like our suffering is being eaten up. And I don't like that it feels like it's being eaten up with this two-dimensional portrait of who we are, that extricates the joy, that extricates the beauty, that extricates the fact that we actually have a really love being Black by and large, and have a really good time on this planet. And so it's like, yes, I want the world to recognize the injustice, but I don't want to be eaten up in this fantasy that my existing is nothing.
Yeah.
I don't like that. And I feel like that's part of the titillation. I think there's it reminds me of the way in which people use slave narratives as pornographic texts.
Right.
I just have that feeling. And I guess, you know, the frustration is that the attention is meaningful, but how to move it out of that.
And this is like a question I probably shouldn't ask in front of 2,000 people, however many people are watching, but how does the acknowledgement that there is an unending appetite for our suffering and an unending appetite for titillation, often white folks are often titillated by our suffering.
Yeah.
How does that, and the fact that a lot of us do not come from money, intergenerational poverty is real. Like, how do we hold those two? How do we hold, and concretely, like, what do we do when people are coming to give us checks to tell them not even a half of what it means to be Black, but like a fourth of a fourth. And that fourth of a fourth has to be bloody, full of sinew, like fucked up, mangled. Like, but we need to take care of grandmama, mama, and our children.
Oh, no, yeah.
How do we talk about that?
Well, this is why I think it's unfair. It's always unfair to place the primary burden upon the more vulnerable. And I mean that really seriously. Like, there's this moment in Byron Hurt's film, Hip Hop Beyond Beats and Rhymes, and he asks, you know, as young MCs, can you rap about, you know, socially conscious stuff? And they say, yeah. And then he, just before they were, you know, it was, you know, Pimpin' Ho, Slim Cadillac, those, right? Like, that was it. And there's this transition moment, and they're very clear. Well, the political stuff doesn't sell.
Right.
And Jay-Z has that moment, right? Like, that's not entirely true now over the arc of the art form, but it's instructive, right? You always have to look at who's writing the checks and driving the money. And this is not a great analogy, but I thought about it earlier today. I decided I'm never again going to ask a question about the talk that Black parents have with Black children. Mm-hmm. And the next time somebody asks me, I'm going to ask, tell me about your talk, your talk with your white children to keep them from growing up into somebody who wants to kill my children and grandchildren.
Yes.
Because, again, it's this fixation on what we have to navigate under conditions of constraint as opposed to those who place the constraint in place, right? And we know, you can see all the time in everyday Black life, the scope of creativity and imagination when people are not under economic constraint.
Right.
So all that to say, you know, I'm not so interested in focusing my critique at this stage in my life on the hustle that Black artists feel they have to engage in.
Yes.
They do have to engage in to make. I think those of us who don't have to, they'll have to talk about.
Right.
I mean, that's why I think that question you asked is so brilliant and important.
Right.
We need to talk about the constraint.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
Absolutely.
And to ask the question, why is this so, why the desire for this?
Right. Right.
You know?
Right. And I think that speaks to me, like, again, this is just like a sort of art question, but you know, you broke Breathe into three sections, fear, flight, and fortune.
Yes.
Right. And so I'm interested, just the cornball in me is interested in like the importance of like the F sounds in those three sections, but also why was it fear, flight, and fortune as opposed to flight, fear, fortune, flight, fear? Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah. Well, this was a riff on both Richard Wright's Native Son and Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me.
Yeah.
And I started with fear in the way they both did. Instead of fly, I wanted to move from thinking about fugitivity to thinking about what it meant to take flight.
Yes.
And the ways in which, and it's such a rich part of our heritage, this idea of taking flight, whether it's on the court,
yes.
right, whether it's dance, yeah. right, this, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that's the tension, and I think it doesn't have to be for mothers, but it is often where you want to hold your baby close, but you also want them to fly.
Right.
And then that tension is what I wanted to get at. And then the final section, instead of fate, talking about fortune, I wanted to think about fortune not in terms of wealth and prosperity, but in terms of the tradition.
Yes.
Because we always are going back to the tradition if we know what's good for us to try to figure out how, even if conditions change, right? So for me, Richard Wright he's been given such short shrift in the field of African American studies, a genius with the pen.
Thank you.
And that In Black Boy, for instance, even in the moments where you can physically feel his hunger, right? I mean, literal hunger.
Right.
And then the stunning beauty of Mississippi before him.
Yes.
Right. Does that juxtaposition, is at the heart of what the fact that we can see the beauty and also make it through the hunger? Or with Between the World and Me, I was really taken with the way that Coates describes thresholds. And so I sort of was trying to think, use that and pick up on it and talk about thresholds as much. I wrote much of the book in Japan. And that's a place where thresholds are super important. What are we walking into? You know, what are we trying to cross over into, which is always the generational question.
Right.
Going from one generation to the next. What's the next step? They're going to cross thresholds that I don't understand, my children. I will give them some of my advice will be bad, right? I will not know how to prepare them for certain things. So some of it is also sort of trying to give them what they need to make decisions that I am incapable of instructing them about.
Right. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, that's sort of what it was coming from. And I was trying to write in, and there's a lot of Du Bois, there's, you know,
right.
Margaret Walker is an influence in it. I mean, it's very much connected to the tradition. Yeah.
I've been thinking a lot about things you write and actually say about improvisation. And the way you brought improvisation into Breathe is just, I'm telling you, if y'all don't have Breathe, you need to get it just to see what Imani is doing with improvisation. But I wonder, and so when you talk about improvisation, I think about style. Mm. And I think about that Fife quote, you know, styles up on styles up on styles is what, yes, I have. And fam, like, I mean, bruh, you wrote Vaccine and you wrote Breathe and like four other books that if given the random book, I mean, very few niggas would think, oh, this one person wrote that book, right? So I'm interested in like improvisation, but I'm also interested in the importance for you of carrying the traditions, but also having styles upon styles upon styles that are dictated by different like discourses. Like, how do you write so many different books so differently, yet still have them feel so soulful and loving of us?
Well, thank
when
you.
The market dictates often that we write the same book over and over again.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, I think if, to be really honest, a lot of the answer is that I'm hard-headed, right? I mean, right. I always say to people, I never do things the right way, like the way people say you're supposed to do them. Mm-hmm. For me, the question is, what am I trying to do first? Second, what do I need to answer the question or do the question? Mm-hmm. And the writing style has everything to do with what's required to give the most robust answer to this question, right? So I don't start out sort of thinking about genre as much as the question itself. What's the information that has to be pulled together? It was important for me with Breathe as opposed to Vexy, which is like gender theory, or May We Forever Stand, which is history. Mm-hmm. I wanted to move the reader in a way that made them feel as much as they think. I wasn't trying to, my favorite metaphor, and I say this all the time, is the one of, you know, two acoustic guitars. Mm-hmm. You're facing each other, we're facing each other, and I strum my strings, and if we're close enough, your strings will move. And that resonance, which is about air, it's about touch, it's about feel, that's what I was trying to get at. Now, you have to know how to strum the strings properly to do that, right? Style matters and practice matters. And you don't get to be good at improvisation unless you know your scales, know compositions, know. And so, right. So you said to me that the other books were necessary to write Breathe. That's absolutely true for me.
It felt that way.
Yeah, because they gave me the stuff where I could move in a way that was improvisational, but it relied upon the work. Yeah.
And can I just say this? I'm sorry if you say talk too much, but like, I just wanted to say one more thing about Breathe that my favorite section of Breathe, my favorite passage, is when you describe your son's voices. Because I think those of us who are lucky enough to, I mean, not lucky, lucky is not the right word, but I think those of us who are lucky enough to have caregivers, be those caregivers parental or something else, I think that one of the goals that I realized after reading Breathe was just like, I would love for someone who is my caregiver, be it my mama, my grandmama, my aunties, to describe their voices, but also my voice. Yes. You know? Because the way you describe your children's voices, and some, you know, one, you got a black voice. And then your voice is like Michael Jackson. And that fam, just like, just also as an artist. It I think it's hard to pull that off in one graph, especially where it appears in that book. Mm. But can you also just, really that question is about the lushness of descriptive language that we see in Breathe, that I would argue we see in a lot of your books, but not so much on the sensory level, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think all of your books are textured and lush, but you seem to be just much more committed to the corporeal and the sensory. Yeah. And can you talk about that for a bit?
Sure. I think it does relate for me, and it's so interesting to talk about this moment, right? Because the world is like this moment. It's no new, but we've been in this moment right. as Black people.
Right.
And when you are in day-to-day life and you experience extraordinary love, the sensorium, you know, scent, taste, touch is such an intensive part of that. And it gets so flattened with the repetition of the videos or just the visualization of the tears or the naming of the death or the photographs.
Mm.
And, you know, the piece that is so devastating to me is to think about what does it mean for someone who, the people who don't get to hold Breonna Taylor or George Floyd or Tony McDade anymore, right? The touch of your hair, right? Yeah. And it's interesting, we talk about this as Black folks in particular, the sort of fascination with our hair, but there's also the piece of the tenderness of knowing what the beloved's hair feels like under your fingers, right? And so to make the point about love and to want to say to the world, this love is extraordinary, right? I think required accessing that for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially because there's experiences of loneliness and heartbreak in these moments too. You can feel a kind of emptiness,
right?
But the way we restore ourselves, right, draws upon all of those points of intimacy. I feel like we should. I feel like there are folks who want to ask you questions.
Okay.
We should also open it up some of the questions. I mean, I have
some
myself, but I don't know. Should we? I know that.
Okay. Hi, Imani, and hi, Kisei. A bunch of audience questions. I think we're just going to have to sort of triage them and go with the ones that people most want to hear answered. So we'll start at the top. This question is for both Dr. Perry and Kiyisei. As writers, what text do you return to for grounding?
Oh, you answer that.
Gee, fan. Okay, I mean, Prophets. Prophets of the Hood, because it was just so important. It was the, you know, people always like, we need Black writing books. We need Black craft books. And for me, Prophets of the Hood is a Black craft book.
Oh,
and I will show people who do not believe that shit. And you can see some of the stuff that I try to do in that book. So Prophets, Gorilla My Love, Fire Next Time. Those are like three foundational texts. Seeing Unburied, because it's like, shit, cuz what? I mean, come on now.
Masterpiece. I mean,
those are before. And Sarah Broom just wrote this book, The Yellow House, which is just like, real talk, it's just some shit we ain't supposed to be able to do, but we all supposed to be able to do it.
And
but,
it's never been done before.
It ain't never
that's
been
what I
done.
That's what I keep, I'm like, I have never, New Orleans, it's not New Orleans, which is probably the city that's been written about most in the world. To write a book about a city that has been written about that much, but nobody has seen it before, it's extraordinary.
Yeah. And you talk about styles up on styles up. I mean, like, one has to be able to, you know, be able to craft a scene on a basic level. You have to have the journalistic chops to do the reportage. You have to have the history chops to understand that. And you just have to understand, and you have to understand character. You have to make it all come together in this way that, like, I just wish I could do. So, I mean, there are tons of books, but those are the four that come to mind for me.
No, I mean, I think, you know, my kids joke and they say, you know, mom has two heroes, Du Bois and old black ladies in Cuba who smoke cigars. Souls of Black Folk is one of those books for me, only because this idea that this, you know, I would like to be better at fiction than Du Bois is when I try it. But an intellectual who understood that you cannot tell the truth in only one form.
Right.
And that's part of it. But the books that you listed, and I don't yet have the full language for what Heavy did for me, but part of it is about, the body is so important in Black experience, and in particular Black Southern experience, right? And about being held captive, literally, and what we do in these bodies. Mm-hmm. And being in them, and I had never before read anything that wasn't a kind of external account of what it means to really grapple with that reality. And so there, I mean, and there's more things than what I ever probably will be able to fully articulate, but that was huge for me, and I think for many readers.
And can I just say one thing about that? Okay. Is you know, you influenced Heavy in so many ways, but one way is connected to our conversation when we first met about virtuosity, because beyond all the stuff, you know, the body and all that other kind of stuff that people talk about when they talk about that book, luckily, like, I really wanted to create a text that had a second person you who was my mother, but that I never called mother or mama until the last line of the piece. And why did I want to do that? Because mama is such a rhetorical device in the way we communicate. You know what I'm saying? Mama say, I love you, key. I don't just say, I love you. It's like the sound of the sentence needs to be like, I love you too, mama. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Mama is so important. So I remember taking that conversation with me and being like, damn, can I pull off this whole book and keep talking to my mama, but never call her mama? Which what I hope people understood was that because she's more than a mama.
That's right.
You know what I'm saying? So the last two lines of the joint is like, whatever, you know, I'm sorry, mama, please forgive me. And you want people to not even realize that I didn't call her that throughout. But like that conversation we had about virtuosity was one of the reasons that I wanted to try to pull that off. So.
Well, you did.
Yeah.
This is a question for both of you. People want to know, how are you doing? Anything make you laugh today or yesterday? Seriously, anything.
So one of the things that made me laugh was, so when members of Congress went with the kente attire, and there were all these memes about it, and one said they look like a Wakanda chessboard. That made me laugh. levity in a difficult moment.
You know, I'm a simple when it comes to laughter. I left my house today and I went to the store, and you know, this person was trying, who happened to be white, was trying to get something in the store, and the sister behind the desk, she kept pointing, and he was like, what? And she was like, I mean, it's not funny to nobody but me. She's like, you better get your ass out there and get your mask. You better get your motherfucking mask.
Get you a mask.
That just made me laugh. You know, because again, just like there's a lot of ways to say that.
Yes.
Get a mask. The sign there says, but you know, like, and she mean no, like, I mean, I think she did mean harm, but she pretty much like, I'm trying to protect me.
No, you're supposed to wear a mask.
You know, you telling me I'm expendable. Take your ass back out there and get that mask, you know? And the person went. So that was funny to me.
We got to start putting that on signs.
Get your ass out.
More serious questions. I'd like to hear your visions for education at all levels as we move forward. What are your freedom dreams, stolen from Sister Bettina Love, for our educational system?
Oh, that's a big one.
You got that?
Okay. I mean, listen, I have thoughts, I have freedom dreams that are sort of practical, which are about educational justice, right? And that are about rejecting stratification education, investing in fully in all children, rejecting the ideas of differential ability, closing the opportunity gap, all those kinds of things. And to that end, I'm actually starting working with a project with a colleague at Harvard, Jarvis Gibbons, where we're actually going to provide access for researchers to all of the journals of Black teachers that were produced during Jim Crow, because there's all this incredible pedagogical practice in the shadows of Jim Crow. But then there's the kind of bigger freedom dreams for education, to think about things, you know, how do you dream a world? How do you allow children to be part of dreaming a world, right? Of completely different types of human relations that are not defined by privacy and accumulation and notions of superiority and militarism and borders and all those sorts of things. And, you know, that is not often defined as education, but what does it mean to cultivate like a deep humanity?
Right. I mean, you know, that the way that I love that question is Derica Purnell, who writes for The Guardian, really has kind of changed my approach to questions like that. Because, you know, if you just ask generally what my education goals are, dreams, I would say that, you know, all children in the world have equal access to second chances, healthy choices, and like robust, abundant love. And the wonderful thing about this place, even though it's so fucked up, is that there are people out there on the ground level in some of these schools doing that.
That's
so
like
my dream is that I can be of service to the people who are already doing that.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? And that's not my idea. Yes. That's Erica's idea, right?
I love that.
You know, utopias are important, but also important is the utility of understanding that sometimes there are people out there attempting to make your dreams reality. And it's like, how can you be of use to those folk? And so my dream is that like I and we can be of use to those people who are teaching 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds the importance of patriarchy without using the word white supremacy, because they're there, they're doing it. I just don't think that we all are supporting them of being as much use as we can. So my dream is to be of much more use to the people who are doing the things that actually are dreaming for me.
This is sort of a follow-up to that. Are you nervous about how white teachers will teach about this moment when schools start? And what do you especially hope that these teachers avoid doing?
Wow. I ain't even thought about that. I can just say briefly, What I hope that teachers, regardless of space, place, and race, do is use this summer, the next year, to look at the ways that we maybe have not been encouraging or healthy sharers of education, right? And so, like, my whole shit is revision. But I think it's hard to revise on the move, especially when you're not being paid anything to revise on the move. So my hope is that this is a moment for all educators to ask themselves privately what it is they need to revise, and then communally like work on that revision together in the service of liberation. But do I have hope that white teachers are going to do that? I cannot say I do. I cannot say I have hope that they're going to do that, but I don't think that's the end all and be all of our formal or informal education. What about you, Iman?
I mean, I think, you know, I was thinking about this question of trust the other day, right? And that part of what we will have to do to get to liberation is to be able to work in communities in which we have mutual trust to collectively do some unlearning and reinvesting and reprioritizing. And one of the challenges is that we tend not to trust white people with good reason, because distrust is a self-protective disposition, right? To keep from being hurt too much.
Right.
And so then, the question for me is, how can, whether it's white educators or community, earn trust that will allow us to actually work together to get somewhere else?
That's right? A great
point. Because it's not that we don't have work to do,
right?
But even getting to doing the work together requires being vulnerable for Black folks in ways, and I think for Indigenous folks, for Latinx folks, for Asian American folks, in different ways, right? Racialization is different for all these different groups, but that's going to be tough.
Right.
Yeah. And it's true of our children too. Our children have learned that self-protection very early.
Right. Right. And something in there has to be, I think we need to speak to the importance of accepting, you know, like interpersonally, when people don't trust me and they're people who I have proved that I am untrustworthy to, I don't need to convince those people to trust me.
Right.
I need to work on that shit inside of me that made me untrustworthy. And if they choose to trust me, they do. But I feel that.
And me too. I mean, I think that's also just generally something that we have to work on as human beings. Yeah.
Right.
Imani, this one's specifically for you. As Black people struggle to breathe as a collective living under anti-Black conditions, how might you describe Black women and girls' struggle and demand to breathe in this moment, especially if we consider their position as mothers and caretakers?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you're caring for people, you hold your breath a lot. You hold your breath, you hold your body tight, you pretend you're not in physical pain when you're in pain. And there are ways that, in particular, there's cultures of self-effacement and self-denial that are particularly found amongst Black women and girls. And the process unfurling that and unlearning that is tortuous, in part because that also becomes, it has a self-protective dimension, right? It's like you can't let all that, everything, all the worry, all the suffering, all the pain come out. You got to hold it close and hold everybody together. And it feels frightening to let some of that go. But we will have to let it go, in part because there's some of the unfair distribution of the burdens can't be resolved unless we make space for some of our vulnerabilities and deferrals of what we need be present. And I'll just say really openly that my own kind of brushes with very serious health situation over the last couple of years has been a sign to me of that. And yet I still, I mean, I've had two experiences where they say, if you waited another a day, you would have died. It happened once. I did the same thing again, right? Because I'm taking care of people. I'm holding things together. And so I do think that's a wonderful question. I think it's an unlearning. It's an unlearning.
There are a number of questions about the hashtag that was trending after the stories on publishing paid me. And people want to know, this is to both of you, do you see potential for sustainable improvements for Black writers or just a few until this moment passes? And this person feels like, I feel every 5 years there's a flashpoint about how poorly Black writers are treated in publishing.
That's a tough one. I mean, what I want to say is I think that younger writers coming, you know, just younger writers, particularly like the poets, seem to be working together and listening and pushing and I think sort of negotiating better deals, I hope. It seems like that than we did. But at the same time, nah, like they're amazing writers that I know in my state who didn't finish high school, didn't finish college, do not have the credentials, but they read and read and read like a lot of our incredible writers historically have. And they sometimes come to me like, because they're like, I need you to tell this editor, this agent that I'm worthy because I don't have like the credentials. And so I think that we are there to do that. The problem with the publishing industry, and I'm just gonna say something. I'm doing work now with like Hollywood shit. And the fucked up thing about this shit is like, as fucked up as publishing is, Hollywood is like a trillion times worse, fam. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, people. I was lucky enough to have Issa Rae by Heavy, and you know, want to make it into a film, and nearly every, you know, financier we went to, they were unabashed. The question was like, love this book. The question is, how do we make it universal? How do we make this book universal? How do we make it universal? Do you know what I'm saying? So I'm saying that publishing is fucked up. And I think one way we have to get it unfucked up is we you know, there are lots of ways. We need people other than like wealthy white folk interning in the publishing. But real talk, we need Black loving editors like Morrison sometimes to have lots of power to do the editing. In the editing, be it in, you know, for Random House books or Penguin books or Simon & Schuster books or the New York Times, the editing, fam, is sort of how you take out the magic or inject the magic. And I just think if we don't get more of us at the editorial tables, I'm not sure how any of this shit actually really changes.
Yeah, I remember when you were in Philadelphia, and I was not at this event, but you, I know, Imani, you were there. It was for Mark at Mark Lamont Hill's store, Uncle Bobby's. You were talking about how you had a deal with a publisher, and there was a young Black woman who was an editor who was asking you to change a lot of things, and a lot of it seemed to be coming from the higher ups, and you talked about how she is basically just doing their work. I wonder if you can comment on
that. Yeah, I mean, I need it personally. I needed to understand. I didn't need to be mad at that person. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, right.
Like, and if I did, there was just a slip. I didn't, that person didn't own the publishing house. That person, you know, had some power, but it took me a while to understand because I didn't understand the publishing industry. And why didn't I understand the publishing industry? Because I was too ashamed to ask anybody who was an actual, you know, published writer, like whether what was happening to me was happening to anyone. Like, I ate that, you know, like I literally ate that shit. And so I think part of it is understanding publishing, but also I just think, and this probably is opening up another conversation. I just don't think American publishing generally knows what to do with like virtuosic Black art, with like Black art that's trying in every fucking sentence or verse to break what came before it and open up possibility. They don't know what to do with it. And even when you get a name, what they want you to do is put your name on some bullshit ass speech and they call that an op-ed or they call that an opinion. But you know what, motherfucker? I'm an artist.
Right.
I'm not going to just put my name on no five paragraph bullshit ass speech. I'm trying to break your shit with every sentence I write. And I think there's a pushback to that. Big time. I mean, I'm being serious right now. Big time.
I mean, can I say something about that? Because one, and I don't know if people realize this, but Kiese was really pushing this conversation several years ago. I mean, it's come up more now, but pushing the question about, let's have some honest conversation about these industries, about publishing, about academia, and to not be moved about by shame or guilt.
Or guilt.
Right. And I think it has done so much for us to let some of that go, in part because even without all of that stuff, there's still a tension between art and market.
Right.
There just is. And so, you know, there's an inbuilt tension, right? And there's all these steps beyond just getting the book in someone's hand, what it looks like, where it is, how accessible it is, right? All these things. Who said you should read it? All these sorts of things. And so,
And also, I just want to add one more thing. It's like, you know, I think when you come from particular kind of spaces that some of us come from, and, you know, we are, I think, confident and sometimes not confident artists, but then when you get picked by, like, you know, the places that, like, you know, you live your whole life wondering if you'll get picked by, what I think some of us have to do, and I will speak for myself, is that, like, you know, if the New Yorker asked me to do something, or the Atlantic asked me to do something, or Vanity Fair asked me to do something, one of the things I have to do is sometimes say, I should not be chosen for that, right? Like, some of the people picking you need to be like, no. But the other thing you need to do is say, no, I will do something else for you later, but here's a young writer who could do that shit better than me. And if you want me down the line, you're going to have to roll. And, you know, some of us have started to do that, but I think we got to do that a little bit more often.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Right. So, which also requires you don't move based upon an idea of scarcity.
That's right.
And competitiveness.
That's right.
But actually a sense of community.
Yes.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah.
There are enough questions here to go on for at least two more hours. I'm just going to pick the next one, and unfortunately, it's going to have to be our last. This question is for Kiese. As a Mississippian who studied and worked abroad and made the decision to move back, I'm interested to hear why you moved back to Mississippi. Do you think you can change Ole Miss? And where do you stand on the issue of changing the state flag? And do you support the Stennis flag? So there's a lot to unpack there.
I moved back home because I allowed an institution to drive me crazy. And I needed to be closer to my God, which is my grandmother. And I needed to come home out of a sense of duty to help. But the primary reason was that I needed to be taken care of by, like, not just my grandmama, but, like, this majestic mess that is Mississippi, Alabama, Tennessee, the Deep South. I came back to University of Mississippi because they offered me the best deal. Am I going to stay at the University of Mississippi? No, I'm not going to stay at the University of Mississippi, especially if they do not take down the Confederate flag, I mean, the Confederate monuments, and replace some of these monuments with Ida B. Wells or Fannie Lou Hamer. I'm leaving. And I'm still, and Imani actually helped me. I asked Imani a few months ago about, you know, where one should go. And Imani was like, you got to ask yourself what kind of life you want to leave. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah.
And one of the lives that I want to live is a healthy life. You know what I'm saying? I'm not a healthy person right now. I'm not blaming that shit on Ole Miss at all. But humiliation is real. You know, I'm a tender black boy. It hurts me to have to go to work every day underneath a fucking Confederate monument armed. And so I just think, you know, I think if this institution, which I think reaps a benefit from having my name associated with it, does not do things symbolically like that, but also double down on, like, you know, livable wages for essential workers here who happen to be mostly Black women. Hell yeah. No, I'm not coming back to this place. And what Imani has let me understand is, like, I can still give love to Mississippi and not live in Oxford, Mississippi. But it's on them. You know what I'm saying? If they do right,
they have to do right.
The people who made us, then I will consider staying here. But the worst thing in the world they want is to give a nigga like me a choice, because I'm going to make the other choice, and then I'm going to tell the truth about that choice that I left. So that's how I feel about that.
We've got
to love you.
I love you, fam. You look better in my back. You didn't even know.
We'll have to talk to the University of Pennsylvania on your behalf, or any of the Philly schools, to get you up here. I want to thank Imani and Kiese. Thank you for joining us tonight for such a critical and essential discussion. I also want to thank the good people at Beacon Press for asking us to host this timely event. And to our friends at home, be sure to follow us on Crowdcast and visit us at freelibrary.org/author events to access our online archive and event schedule. Imani and Kiese, thanks again. Stay safe, be well, and everyone have a good night.
Thank you, Imani.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/author events.